Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. This is Pardes from Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Shoftim. It's now Elul, which means now's the time to think about your cheshbon nefesh, your counting of your soul, something that we have learned at Pardes to do as a personal exercise in time for the Chagim, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, which are all coming very soon. As part of your thinking about what you've done last year, what you would like to do in the future, I suggest more Torah. And one of the best ways to do that and to reward yourself with an amazing, amazing time is to come to Pardes. We have classes of all sizes. You can take off a year, a month, the executive seminar for a week. Whatever you like, we can help you out. So please consider it as you think about the year ahead. This week, Shoftim with Rabbi David Levenkreuz. Rabbi Levenkreuz is an adjunct member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Rabbi David Levenkreuz.
Thank you, Larry. Like many Jewish people, I have to admit, I enjoy watching Fiddler on the Roof. The music, the costumes, the atmosphere. It's a very strong evocation of a world that once was, and very, very sentimental, and speaks to many, many different parts of my Jewish and general identity. But if I have to be completely honest, I do have some issues with Fiddler on the Roof. The first is about the movie or the play itself, and that is that despite it showing the inroads of modernity, despite it starting off by saying that very, very often there was disagreement and internecine strife in the shtetl, on the whole, I feel that it gives a very, very idealized, very, very sentimentalized view of the shtetl. In fact, Commentary Magazine, when it reviewed Fiddler on the Roof in the early 1960s, it actually called the review the best little shtetl that never was. Even in those days, they were aware that this was not what life really, really was like. It was far more complicated and even more negative in many ways than what was seen. So my first is about its authenticity or its integrity as an artistic piece. But I think there are other things as well. One is that for many Jews who are not close to Judaism, it's almost a way to wrap up and put to sleep one's Jewish identity. That's when it really was. That's our background. That's where we come from. It's like Irish who came from Ireland or Italians who came from Italy. If you're talking in the North American context, other countries will have other contexts. That's where we came from. But now we're somewhere different. We may keep a few customs out of memory, but that's when we really were. And now we're really just whatever we are, Americans, British, whatever the case might be. For people who are closer to Judaism, either observant or highly committed, I think the Fiddler on the Roof does something else. And that is very, very often it creates this idea of a golden age. People will speak often if you have a discussion, if people will say, well, that's what they did in Europe. That, you know, should be the end of the discussion. Well, if they did in Europe, that is legitimate. It happens also with the Second Temple. If something was done in the time of the Second Temple, then that has authenticity. For Jews who are more integrationist or more oriented in a modern direction, they'll sometimes talk about the Golden Age of Spain, where Jews were on the one hand very, very Jewish, but also very, very much part of the outside world. But in all these situations, what's happening is we're looking back at something that happened in the past, saying this was our Golden Age, and whatever we have is somehow a part of a representation of it. On a personal level, one of the reasons I live in Jerusalem is that it gives me no excuses. Wherever one lives, I always felt there was a feeling of saying, well, this is how our community does it, but somewhere else, there is somewhere who does it something different, and that's the proper way. The idea is that Judaism is somewhere else. And I know for me, one of the big decisions to come and live in Jerusalem was that I could never have an excuse. If the things are not the way it should be here, I can't look elsewhere and say, oh, well, there's Jewish life like this there or Jewish life like that there. I do it anyway. And there are beautiful and wonderful examples outside of Jerusalem and outside of Israel of communities who are doing brilliant stuff that really is a lesson to Jerusalem. But really, my feeling is that by living in Jerusalem, I don't have that excuse. If something else is better, we need to do it here because this is the center of the Jewish world. And what I'd like to speak about today is this idea of something else being real, something in the past being better. How do we deal in a faith that is extremely past-driven. If Mount Sinai was the central moment when God revealed God's self to the Jewish people, then surely the closer we are there, the better it is. How do we deal with living in the present when we have a faith that is so rooted in the past? I'm going to be looking at it from a halachic perspective, but I'm not only interested in it from a halachic perspective. I'm not only interested in how do we balance the different halachic ideas of tradition and change, but also what it says about us. How do we balance in our own Jewish life tradition and change, and not even only in our own Jewish life, but in our own lives? Because much of life is a question of how much do I continue what I inherit? How much do I forge my own way? How do I combine the two? What happens when they clash? So on the face of it, we're dealing with a halachic matter, but as we will go through it, I think there are lots and lots of ramifications for other parts of life. In the Gemara, let's look at the first source on the sheet in front of you. On the Gemara, in Shabbat 112b, it says, Rabbi Zeira said, in Rabbi Bar Zimuna's name, if the earlier scholars were sons of angels, we are sons of men. Im Rishonim bnei melachim, anu bnei anashim. If they were angels, we are just people. Im Rishonim bnei anashim, anu kachamorim. And if those who before us were people, we are like donkeys. Velo kachamoro shel Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa v'shel Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair, and not even like the donkeys of Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa and Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair, but regular donkeys. Who? Who are the donkeys of Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa and Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair? There are various rabbinic stories that says that their donkeys were of such high spiritual standard that in each case they were offered untithed food, food that the special portion that's given to the Kohanim was not taken from, and the donkeys refused to eat the tithe. So we are regular donkeys. We're not even like the donkeys of Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa and Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair. In modern times, this is very often called Yeridat HaDorot, the degeneration of the generations, if you will, the lowering of the generations. The idea is those who came before us were greater. We are much, much less. We live in times that are not nearly as close to Sinai, nearly as conducive to Torah learning. And therefore, in the halachic realm, this is often expressed that any change we might want to make has to be very, very carefully done, very, very circumspect, because we do not have the power. We are just regular donkeys. And this is reinforced, or maybe comes from, it would be better to say, what it says in Dvarim. Ask your father and he'll tell you, your elders and they will inform you. This is a system that is based on precedent, that's based on the past. Ask the people who were before you and they will tell you. On the other hand, a little earlier in the book of Dvarim, in this week's Parsha, Shoftim, we read the following pasuk in Dvarim 17:8. Go to the judges who is in those days, and they'll tell you what to do. And the interesting question over here, the superfluity, is go to the Levite, who's going to be in those days. And we know that the rabbis hate any superfluity. Why do you have to say the Kohanim in those days? What am I going to do? I'm going to go into like a time machine and go see Kohanim in previous days or in future days? So the Abarbanel says that it's whichever Kohen happens to be on that shift. You don't have to go and find the best Kohen. Whoever you get is fine. And that's a nice answer. You know, take whoever you want. But the Sifri in Dvarim, a rabbinic work, Shoftim 153, says, Rabbi Yossi ben Galilea ben Aglili says the question I just asked. Can you think that a person will go to a judge who's not in the time? A judge who is worthy and who's so recognized at that time. Go to the judge who is recognized at that time. Go to the judge of your time. It's Rabbi Yossi ben Aglili is saying, what these few extra words are giving is legitimacy to those in the each generation to rule. And in Rosh Hashanah 25b, We had this reinforced. Famous lines, Yiftach Bedora, Kishmuel Bedoro. Yiftach in his generation is like Shmuel in his generation. Shmuel was the great prophet of Israel. Yiftach was less great, to put it very, very mildly. He was a very problematic prophet. But nevertheless, Yiftach in his generation should be regarded, should be respected, like Shmuel in his generation. L'lamedocha she'afilu kal she'bekalim v'natnam parnas al hatzibur harehu ke'abir she'abayrim, to teach us that even the most insignificant person who has been appointed a leader is to be regarded as distinguished. Rosh Hashanah is saying something very powerful over here. It's saying, even if the person really is less than, even if the person who rules your community, your country, is not as great. And by the way, we have this in politics as well. Ben-Gurion, Menachem Begin, and make associations whichever country you live in. Those were great people. Who are we now? No, says Rosh Hashanah. Even people in this generation, even if they really are of less significance, you need to treat them with respect. Why? Why? Let's try and answer that. Sefer Ikarim is a work of summary of the Halakha, Albo, by Albo. He writes, it is impossible for the Torah, this is number 6, it is impossible the Torah of God to have conceived all possible cases that ever arise. The Torah could not think of everything that's going to happen because the new situations that constantly arose in human affairs, in law, and as a result of human enterprise are so many that a book cannot encompass them. And we know even in the Torah, we have 4 stories, the daughters of Zlofchad and the man who was collecting on Shabbat, and Pesach Sheni, and Reuven, Gad, and Menashe. We have 4 stories in which, even within the time of the Torah, it was not clear what the halakha should be. The Torah could not say everything. It sounds with kids, if parents of kids will know this, that little kids, you know, you can't tell them every single thing that they're not allowed to do. Therefore, general principles, which the Torah only briefly suggests, were revealed orally to Moshe at Sinai so that the halachic authorities of every generation could use them to derive new laws. Albo says this is written into the system. What happened on Mount Sinai is not that God gave every single last halacha about every single last thing. What happened in Mount Sinai is that God gave general principles. The leaders of each generation need to take these principles and derive new laws from them. In other words, it's written into the system that people should be able to interpret and don't necessarily think that this is a bad thing. If we look at Baba Batra 12a, Rav Avdimi of Haifa said, since the day the temple was destroyed, prophecy was lost to the prophets. Nitla nevuah min hanevi'im v'nitna lechachamim. It was given to the sages. This might seem like a real drop. Prophets speak to God. You have a direct line. Sages use their own intelligence. They might be wrong. Amara Meimar, the Chacham Adif Menavi. A sage is better than a prophet. A prophet has to wait for God to speak to the prophet. A sage can come any time. A prophet is passive. A sage is active. A prophet receives things. A sage is able to be creative with things. There are many, many ways that a prophet can be seen as greater than a sage. A sage uses knowledge. A prophet is because of their position. Each of them have their place, but a sage, according to a Maimer, is greater than a prophet. And this leads us to something which is radically different from Yeridat HaDorot. The Rama, the Ashkenazi commentator on the Shulchan Aruch, the major Jewish code of work, the Rama in Choshen Mishpat 25:2, he says, Kol makom shedivrei harishonim tuvim al sefer v'hemufursamim. Whenever we know what earlier people said, and the latter authorities disagree with them, we follow the view of the latter. Hochim achara achronim. When we know what people said in previous generations, and the modern generation disagrees with them, we follow the latter. In Aramaic, in Jewish religious language, this is called Hilchata Kevatrai. The halakha is like the latter authority. We have Yeridat HaDorot, the degeneration of the generations. We have Hilchata Kevatrai on the value of the contemporary. Round about the middle of the 4th century, in the time of Abaye and Rabbah, a great revolution took place in Jewish life. Up until that point, they really had worked with the idea that if a sage was older, if a sage was previous, if a sage was earlier on in history, we followed that sage whenever there was a dispute. If I disagreed with Hillel, there was no reason to ever go with me. We would go with Hillel. But after the 4th century, this began to change. Perhaps it became too cumbersome. One of the things that happened is that it was very, very clear that people were not just learning their own ideas or their own rabbi's ideas, but there was a historic approach was developing, and people were learning what earlier eras said. It's almost like a small person on the shoulders of a giant might be a small person, but they're still able to see further than the giant. Also, what happened at this time is that different schools of thought started learning other schools of thought as well. Up until that time, it had almost been like, sometimes happens with schools of psychology nowadays, that people only know their own methodology and everything else is not really of value. That really was sort of what was happening until the 4th century. People were only learning their own way of thinking. But then it changed. People started learning other ideas and people started getting a historic approach. And at that point, the idea came, Hilchta Kvatri. We go according to the earlier authorities. But again, that's not all completely simple. Nice answers that we've given to the idea of why we should respect every other generation. It's cumbersome not to. Historic approach. They've learned other systems. In some ways, the present generation is greater. We're able to know what previous generations did. It's written into the system in its very, very essence. But it's not so simple. And it has its detractors too. In a famous passage we read a few weeks ago in Devarim, it said, "And the Lord gave me the 2 tablets of stone inscribed by the finger of God with the exact words that the Lord had addressed to you out of the fire on the day of the assembly." Megillah 19b. In the Gemara, Rabbi Chir bar Abba also said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, "What is the meaning of the word with the exact words the Lord had addressed to you? K'chol advrim asher diber Hashem imachem bahar." It teaches that the Holy One, blessed, showed Moses the minutiae of the Torah. HaKadosh Baruch, Sheherehu HaKadosh Baruch Moshe diktukei Torah, v'diktutei sofrim, and everything that the sages would say, u'masha sofrim atidin lechadesh. This is, and what the sages would do in the future, this is an opposite view to what we saw on your previous page, when we said, when Albo in Sefer Ikarim says, God just gave the general principles. No, says Megillah 19b, every last jot and tittle, everything, this, what I'm about to say to you now, according to some, I don't know if Megillah really says that, was revealed on Mount Sinai. But the Tosfot Yontov then comes and says something else. Although there existed a complete interpretation of the Torah and its commands, there is no generation in which something new is not added. It's an impossibility. We cannot. It is part of life that people come up with new ideas, that people, that circumstances change, and which is without its own legal problems. Do not contradict me, he says, before you even start thinking of doing it, by pointing to the rabbinic saying that God showed Moses the diktukim, the little minutiae and the of the Torah and the minutiae of the scribes and innovations which be introduced by the scribes. For I say that this was not handed down by Moses to anybody else. And he does a diuk. He says, a careful examination of the rabbinic saying shows us that they spake of God showing Moses, not teaching or handing down. By using the word showing, they meant that these teachings were revealed to Moses, but not given to him, like someone who shows their friend an object, but does not give it to him. It is more fundamentalist. It is more restrictive than what Sefer Ikarim says. But nevertheless, it still allows us to be able to have innovation, even if we say it has somehow been given to us before. What these texts show me very, very strongly is that there is a real tension. They go in the one direction and they go in the other direction. There really is a tension between Yeridata Dorot and Hilchata Kvatri, between the degeneration of the generations and the contemporary is not only temporary. Sometimes when I work with students, I will give them an exercise. I'll ask them to write down five things about their life when they were half their age that they want to continue now. They halve their age and write down five things that were true about them then that are either true about them now or they would like to be true about them now. And what we learn from this exercise is with all the emphasis in the modern world about the new and change and, you know, the latest iPhone or whatever the case might be, people want certain things to remain the same. They don't want certain things to change. And it's the same thing when it comes to religiosity. If we just have new things, we're lacking roots. If we only have old things, we become irrelevant, sometimes even immoral, to be working in structures from a previous generation. There is a constant tension between it. I heard Rabbi Riskin once express this very beautifully. He says, we need to think of halakha, and I think this is a beautiful summary of what we've just spoken about. We need to think of halakha as almost a pipeline with Mount Sinai on the one end, that moment when God revealed God's self. And we need at any moment, any time we're thinking of the halakha, especially since we're further away, to be very, very true to that Sinaitic moment. On the other hand, every moment we live in this world is just that much closer to the Messianic era. And we may be further from Sinai, but we're closer to the coming of the Mashiach. Every time we discuss something, every time we do something, we need to have in our mind both things. Am I being true to the past? But am I also bringing myself closer to Zman Mashiach, closer to the time of Messiah? Am I creating a Messianic halakha? Halakha that bits the word service. If I decide something, am I making the world a better, more accepting, more open, greater place? At all time, we have this tension. I often feel this with food. I come from South Africa, and like similar communities, a lot of people are traditional, maybe a little less so nowadays, which means going to an Orthodox shul, but not being strictly observant, observing certain Jewish practices, and a lot of an emphasis on keeping up tradition. So when I went to visit my friends, very, very often their kids are tucking in to the beautiful nostalgic foods of my childhood, kreplach, which is like a little pie that's put into soup, chicken soup, knedlach, tzimmes, all the good Eastern European foods that we know. And I have to admit, my kids living in Israel, living lives which are very much rooted in Jewish religious practice, but very much part of this world as well, hardly know there's foods. We eat mostly vegetarian food or fish. We do eat some of the traditional foods, but not that much. We eat foods from lots of different cultures around us and around the world. And ever so often, I have to admit, like, I feel a little bit bad and I get so happy either if we go out that the kids will just know the traditional gerechten, as we would call them, the traditional foods. Or sometimes I try and make, you know, non-meat versions of the food that I grew up with. But in many, many ways, and I'm what the food that they eat, and this sounds like so simple, really represents the forward and the backwards. It's kosher. All the food is strictly kosher. But there are other values that come into it. Sustainability, caring for the environment, care of animals, openness to the world outside, robust celebration of Jewish and general identity. In some way, I feel that the food we give them is symbolic of this, not rooted in the past, but very, very much drawing from the past, in that the laws of kashrut are paramount, but using those in a way that puts us forward to a different reality. Tradition, change, stability, evolution, these are issues that we deal with in our personal life, but in our religious life and in our halachic life. I'd like to give the penultimate word to Fiddler on the Roof. Fiddler on the Roof, he gives the long monologue about how the importance of tradition, which, by the way, interestingly, was changed from the original Shalom Aleichem, which is much richer than the movie, said Torah. And there's actually a Yiddish production at the moment which says Torah and not tradition. But in his monologue, Tevye says, tradition? He says, why do we have it? He says, for without it, our lives would be as shaky as a fiddler on the roof. without being a part of the generations before us, we lack roots. Our lives would be as shaky as a fiddler on the roof. I would like to claim that if we only have rootedness in the past, if we only have Shmuel Bedoro, if we only have the sons of angels of the previous generations, I would like to claim that in those circumstances, not only will our lives be as shaky as a fiddle on the roof, but we may even fall off the roof unless we root what we gained in the presence. We risk instability that will get us to fall off the roof. But if we do have the past together with the future, if we are able to combine them and work together with them in the way that God expects of us, then I would say it's not a question of fiddling on a roof, but we will have the power to build our own roof in our own way, which represents the highest values of the past and the present. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Levin Cruz. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.